We are discussing COVID-19 outbreaks at meatpacking plants here on the morning show. So recall that COVID spread rapidly at plants in March and April. And remember at the JBS Packerland plant in Green Bay in particular, cases surged from dozens to hundreds in a matter of a couple weeks. The Food and Environment Reporting Network is keeping track. It's identified almost 60,000 confirmed COVID cases and 256 related deaths among meatpacking workers through yesterday. Do you work in a meatpacking plant? What safety measures are in place? What protocols expose you to greater risks? It's 800-642-1234. Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. Sky Chatty is with the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, where he's covered COVID-19 outbreaks at meatpacking plants. Sky, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so what trend lines have you seen as your colleagues have reported that nearly 400 meatpacking plants here in our country have seen COVID outbreaks? What do your numbers tell you?
Yeah, the numbers show that when it first started, April and May, almost every day, several or even more than 10 meatpacking plants were reported to have outbreaks. And the plants that have reported have outbreaks, that has really slowed since then. But I don't think that's any indication that this is over. I'd say that's just more that plants aren't sharing those numbers or that states aren't sharing those numbers.
Okay, so outbreaks have slowed. So there have been, safety protocols inside these plants. Nebraska had the largest number of publicly reported cases with 4,800, and Wisconsin had 860. Do you look at the differences between the states, and what are you seeing there?
We haven't looked directly at that. We haven't reported that out. But my sense of kind of following this for the past several months is that some states do a better job of tracking it and reporting it.
Mm-hmm.
And some states try to kind of not do a great job of reporting it.
Okay, so transparency here is certainly an issue, and yeah, what those relationships look like with state health departments, I would imagine.
State health departments, yes. A lot of it is the companies. Have not been reporting numbers like they used to. You may have seen a couple months back, Senators Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker asked the four major meatpacking companies to show how many workers had actually tested positive and identify the plants that had outbreaks, and all four declined to do so.
Do we have any knowledge as to why Tyson and JBS and Cargill and Smithfield Foods decided to not make these numbers public?
I can't speak for the companies. My sense from reporting is that it is rather embarrassing to have these outbreaks out there. And so they'd like to kind of keep, they don't want to start a panic, especially among their employees, because they want as many employees to continue to show up for work as possible to kind of keep the lines moving.
There have been statements from some of these companies, I can't remember which one, saying, look, we didn't have any federal protocols in place to keep our workers safe. We've been trying to figure out how to do this all on our own. This is on the backs of the Fed, and they're not giving us any direction here. Is there any insights there? Do the companies have a case there?
The federal government has not issued any like enforceable rules or anything like that. They've issued guidelines, and a lot of it's like, you know, if feasible, do this, if possible, do this. The federal government has really left it up to the meatpacking plants to decide what's best for their workers. And as we reported last week, you know, the trade organization, the North American Meat Institute, actually sent a draft version of President Trump's executive order to the USDA, which laid out the language saying, you know, we need to stay open. And so to me, it's more the industry, you know, wanting the federal government to allow them to stay open.
So how do you as a reporter keep tabs on where we're seeing outbreaks? Where do you get your data?
Yeah, a lot of it comes from local news stories, especially early in the pandemic. There was just not a lot of data coming out on meatpacking plants. States weren't releasing it. The federal government hadn't released any numbers at that point. So a lot of it was local reporters asking local health departments how many cases have been tied to particular plants. And that's kind of how it started. Since then, the CDC has started releasing aggregate data, but it doesn't tell you like what specific plants have had outbreaks.
We're gonna pause right there with Sky Chatty with the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting as we discuss COVID-19 outbreaks. We'll be back here on the Ideas Network. Federal safety regulators from OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, they levied fines against a handful of meatpacking companies this month in their handling of COVID outbreaks. Smithfield Foods was fined about $13,000. JBS was fined just north of $15,000. And that touched off a protest last week by the union representing thousands of workers at a Colorado plant. They blasted OSHA over the size of the fine and called the government's response immoral and unethical. What do you have to say about the spread of the virus in meatpacking plants? What do you think of the OSHA fines? It's 800-642-1234. Conversation right here. Sky Chatty is with the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, and he stays with us. Sky, we have officials in Brown County that have have talked about tracking cases, and they've said it's been really time-consuming. When you look closely at Brown County, what do you see?
Well, I haven't looked into Brown County in a while, but several months ago, yes, they did say that after there were hundreds of cases at the JBS plant that they found just tracking those cases too time-consuming. And I could be wrong, but I don't believe any cases have been reported out of related to meatpacking plants related to Brown County, related to those meatpacking plants in Brown County, mm-hmm. Have been reported since then. So it's kind of hard to say if the outbreak is still a problem or not there. My sense is that this is something that just because of the way meatpacking plants are designed to kind of have workers close together and kind of congregating together, is that it's a problem they're going to be struggling with throughout the pandemic.
You learned that companies tried to leverage the agriculture department to intervene when local health departments ordered plants to be closed. How did your reporting lead you to that information?
Yeah, we kind of started looking at, there were a lot of closures early on in the pandemic, I think close to 40, but then they pretty much stopped after the executive order came out. And we wanted to figure out why exactly that was. And a lot of it was the executive order had a chilling effect on these local health authorities, who thought that they had the authority to close down these plants. And then the executive order made them think twice about that. And what our reporting shows, what these documents we were able to get show, is that the companies were actually, in addition to the executive order, they were also lobbying the USDA to kind of intervene on their behalf with these local companies and get them to stay open, even though the local health departments found it a health risk.
What have you seen out of OSHA and OSHA issuing small fines this month?
Yeah, OSHA has really, OSHA is operating with its fewest number of inspectors since it was created in the 1970s. So it really just does not have a lot of manpower right now in order to inspect these plants. I know when we looked at this back in June, some plants with deaths have had OSHA inspections, but then there were some plants that have also had deaths that OSHA had not inspected them. And so it just kind of signals to me that they just do not have enough funding. They just do not have enough manpower to really perform their mission right now.
What have you heard out of unions representing the meatpacking workers? Have they tried to keep these workers safe?
Yes, they've been tracking, you know, they've been advocating for workers. Companies have been installing like plastic barriers between workers. They've been mandating mask use. They've been checking for their temperature. But a lot of it is just because of the design of the plant. They cannot do social distancing just because they need workers close together to be the most efficient to push out as much meat as possible.
In that production process. Sky, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sky Chatty is with the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. He's been covering COVID-19 outbreaks, tracking the numbers at meatpacking plants. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. News is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We are checking in on psilocybin mushrooms and the latest research on naturally occurring psychedelics here on The Morning Show. Psilocybin is considered a Schedule 1 drug, but it's been on a fast track to becoming a prescription medication for treatment-resistant depression. And last year, the FDA, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, it called psychedelic psilocybin a breakthrough therapy for severe depression. What do you think about using psychedelics to treat depression and other illnesses? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. Charles Raison is a psychiatrist. He directs clinical and translational research at USONA Institute. It's a nonprofit medical research organization dedicated to studying the therapeutic effects of psilocybin, and he's a professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Dr. Raison, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, take us to your trials using psilocybin to see if it can help patients with depression. What are you finding?
Well, there are always trials whenever you try to do a trial. And
the trials and tribulations
COVID,
of trial.
Yeah, the trials of Chuck Raison in the world of psychedelics. There have been a number of studies done so far at academic sites by researchers like me when I'm wearing my UW hat that have shown that a single dose or two doses of psilocybin produces really rapid, profound, and long-lasting benefits for people with depression. They have these powerful reductions in their symptoms. Those sort of studies, though, are not what the FDA would honor to give psilocybin what's called a new drug indication so that it could become legally prescribed in the United States. To do that, you have to do these much more legalistic type studies. So we have started one of those studies and it was rolling along beautifully. And then COVID hit. And, you know, one of the challenges is that the way psilocybin is administered is very different than other antidepressants. You don't go to the drugstore and pick it up. It involves some psychotherapeutic support beforehand. And then there's a dosing session. People have these psychedelic experiences that last 6 to 8 hours. And there are two facilitator therapist guides in the room with them that entire time. So three people in a small room in the age of COVID is bad news. And so we had to stop and we went around and around and around. And finally, we decided the only way forward was to do the dosing sessions and the other meetings with full protective gear on. So we asked the patients to wear masks and the facilitators wear masks. This has never been done before. It's really the Wild West, but you know, that really literally all research these days has to be done with that protective gear. So just this last week, we have restarted, and our first new patient since COVID received a dose of either psilocybin or placebo last week. So we are back and running, I'm happy to report.
Well, what happens during this treatment and during these 6 to 8 hours to the patient? What do they experience?
Well, again, it depends. So half the patients get active psilocybin, and half the patients get it's really a placebo. It's called noxin, and it makes people feel a little bit funny. People can have very powerful experiences with either intervention, but psilocybin induces these very powerful, the doses we use induces very powerful psychedelic experience. People see funny things. Sometimes they hear funny things. Seeing hallucinations and stuff. That's not what seems to do the trick. What seems to do the trick is these agents have this remarkable ability to induce these profound mental, emotional states in people. Sometimes people have this sense of what's been called a unitary phenomena. They suddenly feel much more connected with themselves, with other people, with nature, with the universe, maybe with God. And they feel like their life has a deeper meaning than they previously understood. They're not just operating in a self-centered vacuum. They are part of a meaningful, larger whole. Sometimes people will have that, or they will have an experience where they suddenly gain insight into problems that they've been struggling with. Psychedelics have an eerie ability to bring people face to face with their deepest internal conflicts. And this can be quite painful for people. Many people, especially perhaps with depression, will have difficult experiences during a psilocybin session where they will really be, through their entire heart, mind, and body, will come face to face with things that they've been trying to deny or suppress. When those things happen, to the degree that they happen, people tend to have these transformative experiences where they come out of it feeling like different people. They feel like they've gotten a new lease on life, like they've seen something really important. They often feel like they're going to change something in their life. And it's interesting, you know, the drug is only in their body for 4 or 5, 6 hours. But the antidepressant effect can last anywhere from weeks to months to years. It seems like the occurrence of these sorts of transformative experiences is associated with something in the brain and body that sets in motion self-sustaining, what I often call resiliency factors, where people don't need to take a medicine every day to feel good. They've had a change, and it allows them to feel differently about themselves and the world.
We're talking with Dr. Charles Raison, who directs clinical and translational research at the USONA Institute, and we're exploring research advancements in psychedelic medicine, and specifically using psilocybin, the active ingredient in hallucinogenic mushrooms, as a treatment for severe depression. Let's bring in a call now. Brady is joining us from Madison. Hi, Brady.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for discussing this. I'm tearing up on the phone listening to this because it's so important that people have access to this therapy. There are communities of people online who have been researching this for themselves. I'm part of a community, and my experiences with 5-MeO DMT therapeutically, with Harmala extracts therapeutically, and psilocybin, they brought me back and they made me a functional citizen and they gave me a life again. And it's powerful. And you're right. The thing that I learned, just to connect with what he was talking about, is it taught me my worth. It taught me my space in this microcosm, that is our galaxy. And it taught me that I am a miracle and I am valuable. And that's something that unified me with other people and with a sense of purpose. And it's the most powerful therapeutic, experience I've ever had. And the fact that we're even discussing this is blowing me away. I'm coming to tears listening to you. I'm going to stop speaking so I can continue listening to you. Thank you for talking about what matters.
Yeah, Brady, thank you. And Dr. Raison, you know, Brady is really feeling a whole transformation.
Mm-hmm. Well, this really happens to people. Now, you know, in research studies, and this has been emerging out of the UK, there some people have this transformative experience and will continue to really feel, you know, undepressed or changed in ways like Brady was describing for prolonged periods. Some people will have that experience for a few months and then it'll wane. not everybody has the permanent transformation, but it's true. It's really powerful. You know, I've been working with my colleagues down in Austin on a very, very large survey study of folks, not in studies, but folks like Brady who've been availing themselves of these agents just as they can. 2,500 people, almost universally, people report profound benefits in terms of depression, anxiety. Now, we do not have any type of official position on decriminalization. Our single commitment is to the straight and narrow of producing pharmaceutical grade psilocybin and achieving FDA approval, so these agents can be as widely available as possible.
Well. And, you know, there is criticism, though, that the research subjects in the research world focused on psychedelic medicine is overwhelmingly white and economically privileged, and that there's not enough attention to looking at the effects of psilocybin on diverse populations. Do you see a lack of diversity and inclusivity in the research of psychedelic healing?
Absolutely. No doubt about it. It's very, very true. This is one of the, there was a wonderful article just out about this. Some of the work that the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies was doing in Louisville, trying to enlarge the diversity of the sample. There's no doubt about it. We need much, much more diversity, not just in patient populations, but in clinicians that work with these substances. There's cultural baggage. There's a number of reasons why this is the case. One of the most exciting studies I know about is done by a colleague of mine and collaborator down at the University of Alabama in Birmingham, where he is giving psilocybin to almost entirely African-American people struggling with cocaine addiction, mostly inner city homeless folks. Very difficult study to do, but his results to date are striking. He's seeing exactly the same sorts of transformative and clinical benefits that we see, as you say, this more homogeneous Caucasian samples that have been largely done so far. So I personally believe that these agents tap into universal human capacities for transformation. And so finding ways, this is one of the reasons why I'm so committed to the USONA cause, because, you know, achieving FDA approval and legalization and legitimacy that way, I believe, is one of the strongest routes for getting these agents, you know, not just to underserved populations in terms of racial and ethnic issues, but also geographically underserved populations. I divide my time between Madison and a small town in Georgia where my children live. And when I'm down there, I often think, you know, if we're successful, someday these agents will be in this very conservative, sort of off the main grid little town. And that's one of my great goals, is for these agents, if they demonstrate the same effects when we do these larger FDA type studies, I want to see them available widely. And I'd like to see them available not just to people who have a bunch of money or who failed every other known treatment. I'd like to see them available, you know, to people that are having a first depressive episode, so maybe they don't have to spend their life taking antidepressants. This is one of the most important aspects of our work in terms of being a nonprofit. And in terms of working within the system to try to get these agents approved.
Dr. Raisan, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it anytime.
Psychiatrist Charles Raisan is Director of Clinical and Translational Research at the USONA Institute and a professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.